Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to today's Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And we've got a lot to talk about here ahead of what is a really exciting week 8 of college baseball season. We're around the midway point. There's no perfect midway point in a 15-week regular season, but we're right around the midway point here. And there's a lot of great action around the country this weekend. So hopefully everyone, you know, now that basketball's over, maybe we're picking up a few more people into the college baseball world. And if you're listening for the first time this season, welcome in. We've got a lot to talk about here, and we're going to today on the podcast talk about a change that the NCAA has made to the tournament structure, a slight tweak for 2021 only. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and then get into some of the bigger series of the weekend, which is highlighted by number one Arkansas and number three Ole Miss. So we'll have plenty to talk about with that series and more. First, I got to let you know that the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, like I mentioned, we're around the midpoint. We'll have some halfway point content coming next week. Going to let them get another week under their belts. You know, just a lot of schools started so late and, you know, just kind of a weird thing. We'll come out with some midseason stuff next week. But this weekend really, to me, represents the halfway point of the season, and it's been a good one so far. And interestingly, here as we approached the halfway point, Georgetown got on the field this week for the first time all year, and they are just about the last team that is intending to play this season to start the season. It took Georgetown's administration a really long time to approve any sort of a baseball schedule, but they ultimately did, and Georgetown got its first game in this week. We're still waiting on two teams from the Metro Atlantic, Marist and St. Peter's. They've had some COVID issues. And then every Ivy League team but Penn hasn't played. Very uncertain as to whether any of them will play. They're all restricted to playing local competition only. So my guess is some of them never will, and probably a couple more will get to where Penn is now to being able to play some games. But all in all, very good to see Georgetown on the field, and hopefully some of the very few other teams that haven't played this season will be able to join them soon.
And shouts to Penn, because not only are they back on the field and playing, but they seem to be kind of aggressively trying to schedule and try, not aggressive with like the level of opponent. I just mean, they're putting games on the schedule. And so they clearly have made it a priority to get what they can out of this season. So kudos to them. The Metro Atlantic teams that haven't gotten on the field yet, you feel for them. And I don't want to downplay St. Peter's being disappointed not to get on the field, but Marist is disappointing because, you know, they are a legitimate, in my mind, Metro Atlantic contender, or were coming into the season. The Metro Atlantic's best prospect, according to Carlos Collazo, our draft expert here at BA, is Ryan Cardona, a pitcher for Marist. So that's a good team within the Metro Atlantic that hasn't gotten a chance to play. And, you know, I assume the Metro Atlantic is going to crown a champion based on winning percentage, but now you're talking Metro Atlantic teams are 9, 10, 11, 12 games into the season now. And so Marist is just going to end up missing 25% of its season. They're playing 40 game schedules there, and that's tough. So at least 25% of the season. So that's a really tough situation there for the Red Foxes, one of the better teams in the Metro Atlantic, not just this year, but traditionally. On Georgetown, I will leave you with this one thing. Georgetown plays its games at Shirley Povich Field. Are you familiar with Shirley Povich, Teddy?
Yeah, great sports writer of the early 20th century.
Whose son is...
I'm not sure.
Mari Povich, the talk show host. His daytime TV show, Mari. That's Mari Povich's father, Shirley Povich, legendary sports writer for the Washington Post. And that Georgetown plays its games at Shirley Povich Field. I you know, obviously I'm familiar with Mari as you are. He's ubiquitous on television. And especially, I think I just speak for myself. Me and my college roommate went through a phase where we would come home from class and turn Mari on and just kind of like gawk at it, you know, kind of in the same way people watch professional wrestling, I think. You know, we would just kind of watch it and take it for what it is. So I definitely went through a middle of the day, you know, eating lunch in my apartment with my roommate watching Mari phase. But I knew who Shirley Povich was, and I knew who Mari was. I had never made that connection, actually, until I heard Mari on a podcast one time talking about his career and what led him to that point. And I finally made the connection that those two people were related. So how about that?
That is, that's remarkable. I did not know that either. The great thing about Georgetown getting back into action is that it does mean the Big East is starting play this weekend, and that been waiting for that. You know, we talked earlier in the week about Villanova. We've talked about UConn. You know, St. John's was off to a pretty decent start too, and now you know, just didn't have a great feel for what any of those teams really were like, because UConn took a beating against a brutal schedule, and Villanova's 12-2, but really hasn't played, you know, anything close to the competition UConn has. So excited to see that conference get into action. I always feel like the Big East has some real potential as a baseball conference, and it's not going to hit it this season. They just, some teams had just weird non-conference seasons that is not going to make it a multi-bid league. But I enjoy the Big East as a baseball conference. So excited to see them get underway, and happy for Georgetown to join the rest of the country that is able to be playing college baseball this season. All right, let's change gears here, Joe. Let's talk a little bit about this change to the NCAA tournament. And really what it is a change to the selection process, specifically the host selection process. For a long time now, the hosts, the 16 regional hosts, have been chosen, that Memorial Day weekend. Selection Monday is Memorial Day, and the hosts get announced the night before the field is announced, I guess, to give them a little bit of a head start on getting preparations done for regionals. Well, this year they're going to get an even bigger head start, because the NCAA is going to make a decision on them in early May, about 3 weeks early. And the reason for that is that they're anticipating the need to create a COVID testing site at each regional. And it takes a while to get one of those operational and make sure it's running correctly. So they need to give them enough lead time to get that, that done. So that means that they're going to have to pick these regional host sites in early May as opposed to in late May. And as NCAA tournament changes go in this unprecedented season, year, when everyone's trying to play through a pandemic, this is actually a pretty easy one. You know, the basketball tournaments, of course, both went into bubbles, the men in Indy and the, or in Indiana, and the women in the San Antonio area. The soccer tournaments are getting moved entirely to the state of North Carolina. Usually they play on campus sites in the early rounds, but every soccer game is going to be played in the state of North Carolina where their Final Four is held, because they're going to minimize travel, and then they don't have to worry about disparities in local regulations. You can get all under, you know, the state of North Carolina regulations. You knew something was coming for baseball. I wondered if they might try and just group all of the regionals and super regionals together in one place. Probably would be hard to do that in Nebraska, it being Nebraska and just not that many college baseball fields. But, you know, they could have gone to Texas or Florida or something for the first couple rounds and then gone to Omaha. But instead, they're still going to preserve as much of the on-campus atmosphere as they can. They're just going to have to choose these regional hosts early. And that also means that if there are two upsets in a super regional or in a regional super regional pairing, so if neither of the one seeds advances, it's still going to be held at one of these predetermined sites. It's not going to go to one of those upset winners for super regionals because, again, they need the time to create the testing sites. So it's going to look a little different. There's going to be a team this year that makes a late charge that goes and wins a conference tournament. We see this a lot of times, say in the ACC, you know, somebody goes, gets hot, wins the ACC tournament, and then they host. North Carolina did it in 2019. Florida State did it maybe 18 or 17. So that's not going to be possible this year. But again, as these changes go, I feel like this is a pretty light one when you look at what's happened to other sports.
I would agree. I also think it just isn't going to necessarily be, you know, I kind of fell into this when the news of this came out. I kind of fell into the thought of like, wow, this is a huge deal. And I guess it is, just from the standpoint of we're going to know 3 weeks early where the postseason is going to be played. But I don't think the selection process and what the hosts look like, I don't think is going to be all that different. I think that the language being used is based on, you know, merit and location primarily. And I think the baseball committee would tell you that's what they're doing now. The location has been de-emphasized in recent years. You know, you can use the evidence of that year in 16 when we had no West Coast hosts, that location is kind of in the fine print as opposed to merit is in the boldface type. That's largely how it's done year to year as it is now. So I really don't think it's going to look any different. You're right that it does end up robbing some team that, you know, gets hot at the right time, which we see these most years in major conferences. Florida State's definitely done it in past years where they hustle down the stretch to get into host position and then end up hosting. Now, those schools could still play their way into being a one seed. So that's something worth playing for. You'd probably rather host if you had to choose one or the other, but playing as a one seed is not nothing. So there is a little bit to play for there, but you are going to lose the opportunity to have those types of teams pop up down the stretch. The type of team I think it helps is maybe a team like we're looking now at a team like Louisiana Tech, which is trying to do what Stetson did a couple of years ago and come from a non traditional power conference and host a regional. And I think in those leagues, it's less about collecting. Actually, I don't think I know. In those leagues, it's less about collecting resume changing wins and more about avoiding resume killing losses. And so 3 weeks early, you know, Louisiana Tech's got to be like, sign me up, because basically that buys us a few weeks of, sure, they want to also be a one, but that basically buys them 3 weeks that they don't have to worry about playing their way out of being a host in Conference USA. And there are some games that they're going to play in Conference USA that they could take series losses that bump them out of hosting in a normal year. So they do avoid that a little bit. So that, I mean, that's a team I think that could benefit from this. But in terms of what it actually looks like in the end, I don't think it's going to look all that different, frankly. I am, however, rooting for the uncanny valley situation of two upset regional winners playing a neutral site regional in some random place. It'll have a very Dallas Baptist versus Cal in the Santa Clara regional feel to it.
I'd have to look it up, but I don't think we've had a traveling one seed since UConn hosted that regional. And
I think that's right.
12, and Florida State went on the road as a one. It used to happen pretty commonly back when they were trying to spread regionals that around a little more, you know, geographically versus merit-based, and when back in a time when less teams could host. Like now, any team in a major conference, almost however you want to define major conference, like make that tent as big as you want, they can all pretty much host. You know, the facilities explosion has really helped in that way. So I don't think we're going to, it's not unprecedented, I guess is what I'm saying, that if there is a traveling one, and there probably will be a traveling one somewhere, it'll probably happen. And is that going to be unfortunate? Yes, like absolutely so. Especially if it's a place that hasn't hosted in a while, like let's say Pitt gets hot down the stretch and wins the ACC tournament, and well, they weren't picked as a one seed or picked as a host site. Well, I mean, that's unfortunate because, you know, how often has Pitt been in that situation? And they've never hosted before. So yeah, that would be a really unfortunate thing. But again, to when you consider where this could have gone, just the fact that there is a tournament after there not being a tournament a year ago, that's pretty, like we're going to have to be happy about that. But then also when you look at what has happened in some of the other sports and just how disrupted they have been versus what this disruption will be, I think it's going to be largely pretty minimal. Joe, I do think this is a chance though to talk maybe a little bit about, and I don't mean just us, but I like have a broader college baseball conversation about neutral site super regionals. Where do you stand on whether supers should be neutral site or not?
I think I just default to not knowing, like I've not found myself in a discussion about this necessarily. So I haven't thought out both sides of it very much, but I tend to like things on campus sites because I think it's part of what makes the college baseball postseason unique in its own way. So I tend to be, to want to see more stuff on campus. However, I'm not so beholden to that viewpoint that I couldn't be swayed a different direction.
I used to be really into neutral sites. I used to think it was kind of crazy, and I still do on some level think it's kind of crazy that like you get like those are as important games as really exist outside of Omaha, right? I mean, they are the most important games outside of Omaha. And for them to be played, like for some team to have the huge advantage that playing at home provides in college baseball, you know, think about what playing in Lubbock means for Texas Tech, or playing in front of 13,000 fans at the New Dude or Alex Box or Baum Walker means, like it's massive in some cases. And I just, in a lot of cases, I don't think that the teams are all that differently separated. Like you think about, you know, mentioning Lubbock, like 2 years ago when Texas Tech hosted Oklahoma State, Tech was the 8, Oklahoma State was the 9. And so just by virtue of whatever thin line you had created between them as 8 and 9 overall seeds, Tech got the big massive advantage of being the home team. Like, wow, like that's a lot. Like that's way more than like just being 8 and 9 seeds would indicate. So on that level, neutral site regional super regionals make a lot of sense to me. Like you eliminate that, but you also do eliminate, like I was at in 2019, the super regional in Starkville. It was an electric, electric atmosphere. It was the best, probably the best atmosphere I've ever seen a college baseball game in. And like, I know you can point to plenty of other super regionals around the country over the years that have been incredible atmospheres. I remember watching Fullerton and Long Beach on TV and like, you know, at Blair Field, you know, guys are on ladders, like, cause the crowd is packed so tight, trying to get a better vantage point. And I mean, so that's really cool. And so I guess that that probably is better than worrying about like, is this really the most fair way to do it? Because it's not, but also little about the baseball postseason is particularly fair. That's not really the point here. So I guess I am more of the mind now of leave super regionals on campus sites, but it would be a lot more equitable to find it elsewhere, I think.
Yeah, I agree on all points. I mean, that's a good point you make, is that it is a huge slant towards the team that's hosting the super regional, you know, to which they would say to the victor goes the spoils. I get it, but you're right.
And for a 1-16, sure.
Yeah.
Why not? And for the number 3 national seed who has to go, you know, who's playing a 3 seed that upset the 1 in the other side. Like, okay, yeah, sure. You earned that. But in a lot of these cases, when you get down past the top 5, top 6, like it starts to be like, is there really that much separation there? Like, and you see all the time, there are upsets all over the place. Like there's not that much separation. Even, you know, in 19, the 2 overall seed and the 3 overall seed, they were Georgia and Georgia Tech, or maybe that was 2 and 4 or whatever. And neither one of them made it out of a regional. There's not that much to separate these teams, frankly.
Yeah, agreed. But the other thing I think about as you were talking that I thought about is I like that jockeying for position as a host and as a top 8 kind of gives like another layer to the stretch run in college baseball that you don't have in other sports. Like in basketball, sure, in college basketball, it's important that you're a 2 versus a 4, for example. And there is some pride in being the number 1 seed in your region or the number 1 overall seed. But you kind of take that same discussion and you're able to widen it out to a larger swath of the country by talking about hosting regionals and hosting a super regional. So the bubble conversation is a big part of the stretch run, but I'm glad that we go in baseball a little bit beyond that. And we are also having a discussion about hosting. I just think it adds another layer to the season. That's kind of cool and unique to the sport.
Well, we'll have plenty more time to break down whatever implications there are from the change in postseason selection structure here. Again, I don't think it's going to be massive. It's really hard for me right now and for anyone to truly, you know, explain or get a firm grasp on how different it's going to be until we, you know, the schools have not had this information for very long. We don't know who might and might not bid because of this or because of local regulations or whatever. And until somebody makes until we can report that a team is passing on bidding, I'm not going to worry about it. As we're crafting our projected field of 64 every week, I'm going to continue to operate as if it's pretty much normal. And then, the committee throws us a curveball, the committee throws us a curveball, and I'll have 3 weeks of projected field of 64s to adjust to it. So we'll take it from there. But it's something to watch, something to consider, as especially because just the whole process is now accelerated.
I hadn't thought about that. It does make your life, sorry to interrupt you, it does make your life a little bit easier that you're going to know these teams 3 weeks ahead of time. At least you won't have to do that work when you're putting the field together those last few
weeks. I mean, you get like the look at it the night before you put out the final projection. But like if they throw, and so it can be nice. I will miss that because it's like you get one like snapshot the night before. So you get a little bit of a line into their thinking. Like, are they taking RPI very seriously this year? Are they like, can you tell if they're emphasizing something else? Like, what are they looking at? So I'll miss that snapshot, but on the flip side, maybe we'll get that snapshot a little early. I don't know. It's going to be hard to determine, but yeah, we at least will have the 16 host sites right for almost a month before the thing comes out. So that'll look nice at least. All right. We're going to get into some of these week 8 matchups here in a second, but first check this out. Okay, Joe, we're here in the portion of our preview show where we break down the biggest matchups to know, to watch in the week to come, the weekend to come, and try and pick out some keys to these teams winning. And like I said, it is a really stacked weekend. You know, we're only going to focus on five here. We could focus on a whole lot more. There are several top 25 showdowns. The ACC has like three of those alone, and we're not going to talk about any of them here. Sorry, ACC. We've talked a lot about them, and you know, we'll certainly talk about them on Monday. The one to know there, though, the biggest one for me is Florida State and Louisville. So that's kind of the honorable mention here. Watch out for the Noles and the Cardinals. Louisville really trying to get some things right. They're banged up on the mound, and it's been costing them. And we'll see if Florida State can take advantage this weekend. But Joe, let's start things off with number one at number three. That's Arkansas visiting Ole Miss. It's a big one for Ole Miss as they are coming off of a series loss on the road in Gainesville. They're in an absolutely brutal stretch of schedule, and now they have the Hogs coming to town. And this is an Arkansas team that is not afraid to play on the road. They have done very well away from Baum Walker Stadium. They're not going to be intimidated going into Swayze, considering that they swept in Starkville 2 weeks ago. They've just played very, very well away from home. Now, having said that, they did last weekend get pushed pretty hard by Auburn. They win the series, but it was a very tightly played series. And that's an Auburn team that going into the weekend had not won an SEC game and is now 1-8 in SEC play. So while I think Auburn is way better than the record, it does show that Arkansas is not, you can get to them. And, you know, it requires some good pitching, but Ole Miss has that. And, you know, it's going to require good pitching for 27 innings is the real key here. And that's what Auburn was not able to do. Once they got under their bullpen, Arkansas made them pay. And on the flip side, Arkansas's bullpen is, we've talked about it, it's phenomenal. It may be the best in the country. And, you know, scoring runs late against Arkansas is not a position you want to find yourself in. So Ole Miss got to get to Arkansas early and then find a way to hang on. And, you know, I don't know if Ole Miss has that kind of depth in the bullpen.
I totally agree there. I think it's the type of series where you can see Ole Miss, the first half of the series, really feeling good about itself. You've got Hoagland on the mound. You've got Nikhazy on the mound. You know, we've seen at times this year that you can really, that Arkansas offense can get on you fast when it's feeling it, but it's had just as many times where it feels a little bit stuck in neutral. And last weekend against Auburn, for the most part, was one of those weekends. They did just enough. So I think, you know, Ole Miss can have a lot of success in the mound, and it's particularly, like I said, in the first half of the weekend before that depth starts to get taxed a little bit. But, you know, the second half of the weekend, I think the weight really kind of shifts to Arkansas because they are going to be getting into the depth of the Ole Miss, not just the bullpen, but also the third starter. We talked about that on the weekend recap show on Monday, that, you know, Ole Miss has a little bit of a third starter problem right now, you know, and so that's an opportunity probably for Arkansas to feel pretty good about themselves offensively. And on the other side, you mentioned it, maybe Arkansas, again, we've said this about a million times, but, you know, maybe you don't feel super confident in any one pitcher at any given time for Arkansas, but they've just got so many guys they can cycle through that they're going to get it figured out on the mound, and they'll go 27 innings with you with their bullpen. They can do that. They're that talented. And so if you're Ole Miss, I think it's imperative you get off to a good start this weekend. I don't like to necessarily put so much pressure on any single games, but I mean, if Arkansas comes out and wins on Friday, like, I think that makes it a really hard uphill climb for Ole Miss, because I don't know that Ole Miss is equipped, to your point, to come back and win those types of ugly games that you have to win at the end of the weekend, especially when you're looking at a team that is going to be without Tim Elko, who, unfortunately, a knee injury earlier in this week has him out. I believe it's a partially torn UCL.
ACL.
ACL. But all those, you know, there's I'm no doctor, so I can't tell you the difference there. But one of those ligaments in his knee is in not good shape. And so Tim Elko, you know, probably all things considered, best bat in the Ole Miss lineup. You know, it's either him or Kevin Graham out, and that certainly doesn't help. So I just think Ole Miss is in a position where it needs to get off to a strong start this weekend, because if it's trying to come back and win Saturday and then especially on Sunday to try to capture a series win, I just don't know if that's a recipe for success for them.
The interesting thing about that torn ACL is that Elko is not undergoing surgery right away. He's going to try and rehab it and see if he can play on it. No doctor here. I have no idea the likelihood of that, but we do know he's out this weekend, and expecting him back at any time this season is, I would say, unlikely, but you know, we'll see. I haven't seen his MRI, even if I was a doctor, but I'm not. So the larger point for Ole Miss is that they now have to find a way forward, at least in the immediate term, without one of their stars offensively. And this is a team that has been pretty star driven, which, you know, I'm not sure how surprising that is, but I mean, when given that they lost Keenan and Servideo to the draft last year, and then they still found a couple guys to step up and take over the offensive production that those two had for Ole Miss in 2020 and earlier, in Kevin Graham and Tim Elko was impressive. The issue is they now have to find somebody to do that again here. Last weekend, according to Nick Suss, our friend at the Clarion Ledger, Kevin Graham and Tim Elko combined to hit 440 against Florida. The issue was that nobody else did much of anything that weekend, or at least not enough. And, you know, so TJ McCants has played well, but he's not the power threat that Elko is. Like, they don't have that big time power threat now. He has 9 home runs on the season. There's no one that's gonna pick up that unless, you know, Ben Van Cleave figures it out, or Cale Baker. You know, they don't have those kinds of big time power bats on the bench. They're just gonna have to get power production throughout the lineup. They really need Hayden Leatherwood to find something. That would be very helpful. But this is going to be a different offense without Tim Elko in it. And they don't have any time to try and figure out who that, you know, who is going to provide that offense and how that offense is going to run. You know, not only is this the number one team in the country, but this is a pitching staff in Arkansas that can run a whole lot of different looks at you, lefties, righties, power, you know, more finesse, big time curveballs, exploding sliders, like whatever you want. Arkansas's got it. So even if you figure something out against, you know, say Zebulon Vermillion, like, well, is that going to play against Wicklander? Is that going to play against Lockhart? And then how is that going to play against Paulette and, you know, Jackson Wiggins and all these other different looks that they're going to throw at you? So it's a really tough weekend to figure it out from that perspective. And it doesn't get any easier because then they go to Mississippi State the following weekend. So they're going to have to try and find some answers offensively in a hurry.
Indeed. It's just going to be a little bit of mix and match, but they've already started to do some of that. You know, they had 2 midweek games, which is probably helpful this week to have had midweek games to try to play with some stuff. But, you know, guys like Trey LaFleur and Cale Baker played in the midweek after having not played for a little while. So, you know, maybe they're messing around with the idea of those guys being back and being a part of the offense. You know, Ben Van Cleave has been struggling. So, you know, he's a question mark. Does John Rhys Plumlee somehow end up in more playing time here? So they do have some guys.
I'm here for that.
They did, no doubt. They do have some levers to pull here, but none of those levers, well, I feel confident in saying anyway, they're not going to pull a lever and get like a new Tim Elko. That's just not going to happen. But they do have some guys. It's just a matter of finding the guy who's going to be most consistent over time. And boy, isn't that always the question.
Absolutely. We've talked plenty about Arkansas. Arkansas's keys here are the same as they always are. Just, you know, find the right mix on the weekend in terms of, you know, pulling the right levers. The pitching staff, they got plenty of levers to pull, and, you know, do enough offensively, play amazing defense. That's Arkansas. That's what they're going to be trying to do here on the road. I think that, you know, I am very interested to see how Ole Miss lines this up against what Arkansas can do on the mound. So we'll definitely be watching this series, which you can watch game one of on SEC Net before moving over to SEC Network Plus the rest of the weekend. All right, Joe, let's head over to the Big 12, where there's a big showdown in Lubbock. It's Texas Tech hosting TCU. We kind of alluded to this on the Monday podcast, and we talked about how Texas Tech is a totally different team outside of Lubbock, and that showed up again this last weekend when they lost a series at Kansas State. And TCU is coming in with all kinds of momentum. They've really figured things out over the last couple of weeks. They're 6-0 in Big 12 play. They are the conference leaders right now, but they have the very unfortunate task of having to go and prove it in Lubbock. It's again, Texas Tech just plays so much better there. They haven't lost a series in Lubbock since 2018. Just good luck with all of that for TCU. But at the same time, TCU has a lot of positive things going for it. It's been pitching well. It's just been playing well overall. And they do seem, after losing that series to Gonzaga, and then, kind of stumbling through a couple games in the immediate aftermath of that, they do seem to have really righted the ship here over the last couple of weeks. And, Joe, this has all kinds of implications in the Big 12 title race. I mean, Texas is going to have its say in that as well. But, if TCU wants to be in the mix, this is the weekend that they really have to show it.
For sure. Like, this feels like it's just a huge opportunity for TCU losing the series is A, not going to be anything to be ashamed of because of how difficult Tech is to play in Lubbock. It's also not going to derail the season for TCU. Like, all of their big picture goals would still very much be in front of them. However, I think this is an opportunity for TCU to show this is the team we thought it could be, and maybe even better than we thought it could be in the preseason, because, we had them pegged roughly in the middle of the top 25, 15-ish, 13, something like that. Yeah. So, this is a team that could maybe even be a little better than we thought it could be. If they're the type of team that can go into Lubbock and win a series, that's very much on the table. And it does feel like some of the softer side of the Big 12 they face so far. But it does admittedly feel, like we talked about on Monday, a team that's really started to figure out who it is. Some of the guys are just playing better, and that always helps, right? It's really easy to say this team has figured some stuff out when, guys are just playing better. But I do think they've really kind of narrowed on who their guys are. They feel like they've settled on the guys who are kind of things kind of revolve around. The things on the mound have gotten a little bit better. And for Texas Tech, I'm trying not to overreact too much to things I wrote it up in the top 25 recaps because I think it's notable. But, Patrick Monteverde got hit at Kansas State in a way that he hasn't been hit all year. And I think at this point we can be confident that he is clearly a very, very good pitcher at a Big 12 level, perhaps one of the best in the Big 12 in terms of just college pitchers. So I think that is real. And I'm trying not to overreact though too much to the idea that maybe he's, maybe he had been pitching over his head. He might have been to this point. But the thing about Texas Tech is that I feel like they had been kind of masquerading on the mound as a team that they weren't necessarily, because, I wonder if even Tim Tadlock knew how good Patrick Monteverde was going to be through the first 6 weeks before he got hit up in week 7. So he'd kind of turned into like this workhorse that I certainly didn't anticipate, and maybe they didn't either. And Brandon Birdsill had been pitching so much better of late. So you really had kind of two workhorses in a way that I didn't anticipate with them. And it kind of made them a team that I thought maybe they weren't. I think it's more of like an Arkansas type team where this is typically the way they are, where they're just going to throw a lot of different guys at you and they're going to figure it out as they go along. And I think ultimately that's still the team they are. I think just for a few weeks, because of the overwhelming success of a couple of guys, they were able to masquerade as something else. And that's not to say that they shouldn't do that if that works. But I think maybe now they settle back into more of being what I think we anticipated them being from a pitching standpoint all along. But we'll have to obviously see on that. The offense is the offense. Like, I don't have really too many questions about that. I was talking to a Power 5 coach earlier this week who, unprompted, we were kind of tangentially talking about teams that are, highly ranked, but just unprompted told me that Jace Young is his favorite player in college baseball. And this is a coach, by the way, who doesn't play Texas Tech. Like, it's not like a Big 12 coach. Like, it's a coach who, you know, just was like, you know, I really like the Jace Young guy. Like, he's my favorite player, my favorite swing in college baseball is the way he phrased it. So, and, you know, there's a lot to like, obviously, there. But the Tech offense is the Tech offense. Like, they've got the star power at the top with Young and Cal Conley and Drew Baker and, you know, Noisy, maybe not having quite the season he would have hoped, but is still productive. But the depth is there as well offensively. They've got a lot of guys who can do a lot of different things. So, you know, that's been right on par there.
So that offense, there's really no question about how good it can be. You know, even in this series loss, they still had a game where they scored 17 on K-State. And oh, by the way, that was the game that Jordan Wicks started, and that's supposed to be the first rounder. That's the guy you're not supposed to beat. So there's really no question about that offense. What I have the question for you, Joe, and you know more about TCU than I do at this point, and I really need to kind of pay more attention this weekend to this series so that I can kind of get up to speed on the Frogs. But okay, so how are they going to go about stopping it? They have Russell Smith, they have Austin Krobe, they have Johnny Ray in the rotation. Those three guys have been pretty solid all season long. Feel good when they're on the mat. Feel good when Halen Green gets in the game to close. He's not our traditional closer. They're going to use him in multi-inning. So he can cover a couple innings backing up one of those guys. Charles King has been kind of moved into a bit of a tandem situation. He's experienced. You know, that's fine. Do they have what it's going to take, though, to cover 27 innings against that offense in that ballpark? You know, a couple other guys in the bullpen that have been used a fair amount that have good numbers, River Ridings and Garrett Wright, they haven't really gone to in Big 12 play much. I think both of those guys, despite the fact that they've combined for 16 appearances on the season, I think they have a total of two Big 12 appearances between them. So I don't know, is there a concern here that if Tech either waits out the starter or gets to the starter that, you know, TCU isn't going to have anything behind it?
Oh, 100%. That's the concern. I mean, that's the way Tech really makes this series look decisive, is it forces TCU's hand early in games, you know, to pull Krobe or Russell Smith in one of the first two games and really, you know, touches up TCU's depth on the mound. That's how this plays out in my mind, if it doesn't go well for TCU. But that's, if you're TCU, I think you can look at it the other way, where never have they felt better, I don't think, about what they've got going on the mound, because, you know, Russell Smith's been good all year. Austin Krobe has pitched better of late. Charles King has been better of late. His numbers just look kind of okay now, but they've been better actually the last few weeks. So they've been, you know, kind of tandeming him with Johnny Ray. So I think TCU feels like, you know what, we're getting them at a good time. So I think they've got confidence there, but I think you're right. The question is, what if one of those first two starters goes 2 1/3 and Tech puts 7 runs on them? That's not the recipe.
That's bad, but like, I would be more concerned with what if they go 5, because you can't ask Halen Green to do 4. Or if he does do 4, you've lost him the rest of the weekend. So, you know, that would be my concern, like that they just get 5 okay innings and that they leave the game either down a run or tied, or even just up one run. That it's an okay start, nothing more, nothing less, and your offense hasn't helped them a whole lot. And you're looking at it and like, okay, how do we bridge this to Halen Green? How do we get Halen Green the ball with the lead? That would be my, like, if they rough up one of those first two starters, like, that's just a problem. There's not, that game's probably just going to go down as a loss. But how do you manage a tight game in which your starter only gets you 4 or 5? That would be my bigger concern for TCU.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need, in that scenario, you know, they're going to need somebody to do something that they haven't really done, whether that's, you know, you mentioned Garrett Wright or River Ridings, those guys getting exposed to more Big 12 play and being successful, or guys like Drew Hill or Dalton Brown, guys who are a little more proven that just haven't done it this year, haven't had a ton of success this year, to be more effective than they've been. So, you know, in that scenario, look, I mean, if TCU gets, you know, 7-7 and then gets 4-4 from the combo on Sundays, like, they're feeling great about that. Anything short of that, though, they are going to be asking guys to just do some things they haven't done so far this season. I think that's the long and the short of it.
All right, so that is your Big 12 series of the weekend. We'll have plenty to talk about coming out of that one, I am sure, because like I said, this is a series with some really significant bearing on the Big 12 race going forward. All right, let's flip back to the ACC, or the SEC, excuse me, where Florida is taking on Tennessee in Knoxville. It's a top 10 series. This is something of a rivalry. I don't know how much it extends to the baseball field. Like, it definitely does, but I don't know that it's as intense as, you know, it's definitely not as intense as a Florida Vanderbilt or, you know, any number of other SEC rivalries, even South Carolina and Florida, I don't think. But at the same time, this is a top 10 series, and it hasn't been a top 10 series in, oh boy, it's been several years since we've had this series mean this much. Florida coming off of a big series win at home against Ole Miss. Tennessee riding high. They haven't lost a series all season. And so the reason I really want to talk about this series is because I feel like we haven't talked much about the Vols here on the podcast. They're up to 7 in the top 25. And it's just been really because for the last month and a half, they've just been humming along. Like, we talked about putting them on upset watch against a couple of teams. Did not happen for any of those potential upsets. Tennessee took, like, just swatted them away like it was nothing. And, you know, here they are coming off of a nice series win at Alabama. The Tide pushed them. They really gave them a good series. While everyone was locked in the basketball game Saturday, that was a fantastic game. I finally did flip over, but Alabama and Tennessee were playing extra innings. And I was like, well, I mean, sure, the basketball game might be good, but like, Alabama and Tennessee, they're in extra innings here. And finally, with like 2 minutes left in regulation, I was like, okay, fine, I'll watch the basketball game. But Tennessee got all they can handle down in Tuscaloosa, and now they've got the Gators coming in Knoxville.
Yeah, two things can definitely be true with Tennessee. On the one hand, they have played a lot of close games the last couple of weekends. Like, both the LSU series and the Alabama series could have gone either way in a different scenario. So that is one thing. They've also played, this will be the first real big test Tennessee has had within the SEC. You and I like Alabama as a team, but there's no denying their record in the SEC is not good right now. Same with LSU, same more or less with Georgia. So that is also true. And on the other hand, this is a team that's probably better than most people have noticed so far, because they haven't played those high-profile series yet. I also think it's a team that
25-5.
Yeah, no, it is impressive. Like, there's just no denying that. And even some of their other stuff on the schedule, right? Like, we banged
most,
them.
Most wins in the country.
We banged them on that Indiana State split. Now it's kind of like, well, that's a pretty good result. I mean, they would have preferred to win that series. You would predict them to do so. But, like, you know, that's obviously serving them pretty well these days. So, but at the same time, it's also a team that I think could honestly be playing better. Like, I think there are some places where they could still show some improvement and maybe be even better than they've been so far, because offensively they're pretty top heavy, where, you know, Liam Spence and Jake Rucker have been excellent. Drew Gilbert's been really good, but, you know, Jordan Beck is hitting below 250. He's hit with some power. So sure. Like, you know, that he has been an effective offensive player, but under 250, Max Ferguson is hitting 220. Connor Pavlone's hitting 215. So I think there is actually some upside potential there for this Tennessee offense to be a little bit more consistent than they've been so far. And the pitching staff, I think, deserves a lot of credit. I mean, it's pitching staff that's dealt with injuries, whether you're talking about Jackson Leith, who's gone for the year, or a guy like, you know, Chad Dallas has missed a start. You know, I feel like they've had a couple of other guys who have just missed a weekend here or there, and they continue to patch it together. And a lot of thanks is that true freshman Blade Tidwell, I think, deserves a lot of thanks for that. I also think it's just, you know, you talk about these pitching staffs like Arkansas that are able to just throw a lot of guys at you. Tennessee is that as well. Tennessee does have more guys who have eaten up a lot of innings, so they're a little more defined than Arkansas is. But when they're pitching at their best, I do feel like it is a type of pitching staff that what they're going to do is go to a lot of different guys in the bullpen and give you a lot of looks, because they do have a lot of guys who give you varied looks and also a lot of guys who can really bring heat at you. So it's a good pitching staff that has been hampered by some injuries, and they've continued to kind of just to muddle through it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting pitching staff. Like you said, they've done a great job at managing it there. Tony Vitello and pitching coach Frank Anderson just done a great job. And we talked about this when Tony was on the podcast in the offseason, just how Frank does a really good job at, you know, getting guys innings and, you know, not being as concerned maybe about roles or, you know, at least getting guys comfortable pitching in different roles. You know, you've got Sean Hundley, who's a reliever, who's thrown 30 innings already. You know, that you're not going to find that on too many teams around the country. And they've been 30 really good innings. And Kirby Conley, it doesn't have quite 30 innings. He's got 24, but you know, he's also, you know, going out there and pitching really well. And Redmond Walsh has pitched very well for them at the back of ball games. So if they can get the ball to those guys, you know, Walsh is more of a traditional one inning guy, but Hundley and Conley, both multi-inning relievers, they can get the ball to them. You know, they're going to be in pretty good shape, and their starters have done a good job of getting them the ball. And like you said, Joe, I mean, it hasn't always been the same collection of three guys, and they're doing this without preseason All-American Jackson Leith, who could have pitched in multiple roles, but it is lost for the season. I've been very impressed. I knew that the pitching staff was capable of this, but just to see them go out and do it and, you know, have these kinds of performances from, you know, okay, Tidwell was a guy who was getting a ton of helium right before the draft. He came out of quarantine and was like immediately pumping 100, and guys were running in to see him, and it just happened too late in the process. Like if it had happened a month before, maybe he wouldn't be at Tennessee right now, but he is. And, you know, he's done everything you could ask of him as a true freshman pitching in the rotation. And okay, you don't have your preseason All-American in Jackson Leith, like fine. Redmond Walsh he's been through this. He's a veteran. He's ready to go there at the back of games, and they found other answers. And so I think that Florida is going to be in for a tough weekend at the plate, just knowing what Tennessee can throw at it. On the flip side, I don't know. We haven't gotten word from Florida whether they're going to continue with their tandem starters. Kevin O'Sullivan was non-committal at the end of last weekend. We talked about, you know, what he said and how, you know, it's certainly an option, but that what he saw from Franco Aleman and Christian Scott in those roles either gave him the option of continuing it in that way or returning them to the bullpen, just using them more aggressively, going to them faster or for a longer appearance. So we'll see what they do this weekend. Regardless, I think the Tennessee offense is solid. The Florida pitching staff has what it takes to limit them. I think I'm a little more interested in the matchup of the Vols pitchers versus the Gators hitters. Florida still maybe searching for some things there. Judd Fabian hasn't, he continues to hit home runs and not, you know, strike out. He hits home runs and strikes out way too often. That's finding a little more consistency from him would be a nice step forward for the Gators offense. But, you know, I just think in general, the Gators could use a little more consistency, but, you know, at the same time I say that, but they scored runs at South Carolina. So, it's not like they don't have the ability to do so.
I think Tennessee, more so than Florida, is going to want to ugly up this series a little bit, because I think that's an opportunity for them to play to their strength a little bit, which is, if we're going to have to go like arm for arm in the bullpen here, I actually kind of like Tennessee's opportunity to win that way. Because Florida has kind of scrambled to figure out what they're going to do out there on the mound, and maybe man for man, they're more talented than Tennessee on the mound, but this is kind of how Tennessee plays. Like they're just comfortable playing that way, that, you know, they're going to have a 4-inning relief appearance from a guy if that's what they have to do. And so I think Tennessee would be perfectly happy getting this game kind of uglied up to where they're not playing catch up against a Florida pitching staff that could be, that could shut them down, to your point. So I think
I think that would be a problem. Like the because Florida really, if they shut down Liam Spence and Jake Rucker, things start looking a lot bleaker for the Tennessee offense. They could get production from other guys, but they just haven't gotten that kind of consistent production.
Yeah, if this series gets played clean and pretty straightforward, I think Florida's got a really good chance here. If Tennessee can really kind of drag Florida down a little bit and force this to be like a let's go arm for arm in the bullpen kind of thing, I think Tennessee might be in good shape in that scenario.
Yeah, I would agree with that if this goes to script. If Florida, just generally right now, I think when you're playing Florida, you have to get them off their script. Whatever they decide that script is, whether it's traditional starters, whether it's tandem starters, whatever Sully decides the script for that weekend is, if he can stick to that, if Florida is allowed to play to that plan, they will win. If you can get them off of that, that's when they start to run into trouble. Is Tennessee the team that can do that? I don't know. Tennessee causes problems on the bases. They have guys that can run the ball out of the park 1-9, but no one power hitter. So it's an interesting offense. It's a tricky offense to truly shut down at any one point, but it's also not the kind of offense that I associate with, huge innings out of. So I'm intrigued by this series. And like I said, this is the biggest Tennessee Florida series in a decade, at least, and more than a decade, like 15 years probably. So that by itself is pretty cool, and I'll be interested to see how Knoxville reacts to having the Gators come to town for a top 10 showdown. All right, let's. My last series that I've picked out here is a rivalry series, and that could mean one of two really big ones. It could mean Oregon and Oregon State, but frankly, we saw that series a month ago or something in Corvallis. Oregon won it. We talked about it then. I think mostly things are still true what we said at the time, except that Oregon's proved itself a little bit more. So, Joe, let's go to the Big Ten. It's Ohio State going north to play the team up north, as the Buckeyes call them. It's Michigan, and the Wolverines, we have them in the top 25. They've been in the top 25 all season. They are still looking for a big breakthrough weekend. They really haven't had it since opening weekend when they beat Iowa 3 out of 4 in Texas. Everything since then has either been like, okay, you swept Purdue. That's what we expected out of you. Or like, why did you just go 2-2 again? Or why did it look so hard to beat Penn State? This is their opportunity to make a statement. This is also an Ohio State team, however, that just made a statement by sweeping Indiana in Columbus. The Bucks are coming in very hot. That made them, right there in the mix at the top of the Big Ten, along with the Wolverines, Nebraska, and, Ohio State moved past Indiana, but I think the Hoosiers are still in the mix there. And now if Ohio State can build off of that, this would be a really big opportunity for the Buckeyes to kind of shake things up in the Big Ten.
And you're certainly heartened. If you're Ohio State, you're certainly heartened by what you did last week. And that felt like a really big series in terms of getting things moving in the right direction for a team that really had just kind of been treading water. They had some good weekends. I saw them have a pretty good weekend to start things off in Greenville, the first weekend of Big Ten play. But since that point, they've really, treading water is probably actually being a little kind to what they had done. That last weekend felt like a little bit of a breakthrough. And the big story, of course, was Seth Lonsway with the way he dominated. And that's, if Ohio State is going to be a team as good as we thought they could be, and certainly as good as they hope they can be, that's item number one on the list is Seth Lonsway dominating to that level. But it's going to have to be more than Seth Lonsway, because college baseball history is littered with tons of examples of teams with just a number one that can go out there and beat anybody in the country. And then what do you get after that? I mean, you look at, Minnesota just had Max Meyer, and, outside of the year when they also had Patrick Fredrickson having a historically great freshman season and had a good bullpen full of veteran guys and a veteran lineup, Max Meyer by himself could not lift Minnesota up to, being a postseason team, at least in the sample that we saw. So it has to be more than that. And Ohio State showed that last weekend that it could be more than that. You know, whether it's, you know, in this case, it's Garrett Burhan and Jack Neely, but you know, whoever it ends up being, I think those are the two guys that are, that have pitched well. And those are the guys that, that have the stuff also to dominate in the way that, that Lonsway does from time to time. But I think it was a real positive weekend for it being not just a one man show, but being a good fully formed pitching staff. And then the offense is a little better. We talked about how much the offense had struggled, and it wasn't, you know, an offensive explosion by any stretch of the imagination in their series win over Indiana. But, you know, now it's not just Cade Kern and a bunch of guys. You know, Zach DiCenzo had a good weekend, and he's now up hitting over 300. So maybe a little bit of a work in progress offensively that's at least moving in the right direction. And Michigan has a lot to prove here, like you said. I mean, it's just such a strange season for Michigan. You know, part of the strangeness, to be honest, is that the number of Monday games they played, where it just feels like every time you and I talk about them on a Sunday night to try to rank, you know, we just kind of feel like, well, we really wish we could see a fourth game, whether that's, you know, in the opening weekend where they end up winning 3 of 4 against Iowa, like that would have made us feel a little bit better about them. But they've also got Monday losses to Michigan State and now Maryland. Made it to where, like, you know, maybe we would have viewed them a little bit differently had we had those data points ahead of time. So really weird season. And I've not done a full accounting of, you know, where some of those inconsistencies are for Michigan, but we certainly still believe in the talent here. And you know, that's why we still have them ranked where they are. So it's I think a big series on both ends in a Big Ten, frankly, that, probably looks a little more condensed than the Big Ten would ultimately like if you are going to start talking about what the Big Ten is going to do in the postseason. I'm not saying that it's the worst case scenario has played out for the Big Ten in terms of getting as many teams in the postseason as they want, but it certainly is not a great start down that road.
I would say in some respects, Michigan has found the landmines that probably existed coming into the year. I remember writing their preseason capsule and thinking like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, we have them ranked and like, here's all the reasons why, but like also the reasons why this might not go as well are pretty apparent as well. They have not been quite as deep on the mound as I think that was anticipated. Blake Beers, who was really, really good in the early going last year, has not been very good this year. Stephen Hadjer, who I think still is, you know, an incredible pitcher, worthy of being a preseason All-American, hasn't quite pitched that way. I mean, he's been very good, but has he been the best pitcher in the Big Ten like I thought he was going to be? No. He's been very good, but not quite to that level. So that's, those two things aren't going quite as well as maybe you would have thought they would. Michigan's pitching well overall. That's not particularly the problem. I think the bigger problem is offensively, where they're getting some good offense from grad transfers Christian Molfetta and Benjamin Sims, and Jimmy Obertrop has 8 home runs in 19 games in Big Ten play is pretty significant. You know, hitting home runs in the North this time of year is not the world's easiest thing. And I know Michigan played 2 weekends, not in the North. But still, outside of those guys, you know, Clark Elliott's been fine, and they're still looking for some other answers offensively. You know, they're going to have to find some more consistency from some other guys. And, you know, this weekend, trying to get the offense right against that Ohio State pitching staff, it's really tough. And I have concerns on that front, just in terms of this weekend, like how are you going to get things going when you're going to face a pitching staff that has the ability, and it's not like Ohio State does what they did last weekend. It's not like they've done that every week. If they had done that, they wouldn't have been in the position where last week was so critical for them. But just having seen that last weekend, having seen what Lonsway is capable of and what Burnhead is capable of and Neely and all those other guys, that's disconcerting for an offense that hasn't been fully locked in yet. For Michigan, the kind of X factor here is that if you follow college football at all, you're well aware that Ohio State has more than had Michigan's number for the better part of the 21st century. What's a little less. I mean, obviously, it's not as well known because this is college baseball and not college football. But even within the college baseball circles, I don't get the sense that this is as prominent. But Greg Beals is 15-5 against Michigan. He's been at Ohio State for a decade now. He just doesn't lose many games to Michigan. Does that matter this weekend? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. But you know, they just don't lose series to Michigan typically. And so I would not be at all surprised if Ohio State keeps this going, both because of the pitching, the advantage they should have pitching to, you know, in terms of the matchup between their arms and Michigan's bats, there it is, that advantage. And then also, you know, yeah, there's a number next to Michigan's name. Yeah, Michigan went to the College World Series and finished runners up. We're one win away from the national title, but nobody at Ohio State is going to be intimidated by that at all.
Did you see that the Sunday game in this series is getting the ESPN2 treatment?
It did, as it should. I have complained so many times that college baseball does not market, does not promote, does not showcase its rivalries enough. Here is the best rivalry in the Big Ten. They are both very good teams. Like, let's do this. I'm happy for that.
I also just don't think they've done a very good job of, I get why so much of the volume of college baseball games on TV comes from the SEC in particular, but also the ACC. Part of it is also because ESPN owns those conference networks. I get
that. Yeah, I mean, that has more to do with FS1 not wanting to show college baseball, I would suggest, and ESPN having the deals it has with the conferences it has.
For sure. So I get the business aspects of it, but I do think there is a bet you could make on, and it's the same bet the Big Ten has made on what the conference could be if you move the schedule back. We're not going to get into all that, but I'm just saying that, you know, you put anything Michigan, Ohio State on TV, and I'm not saying it's going to outdraw, you know, it's certainly not going to outdraw the final round of the Masters, which will be going on at the same time. However, you put those two big brands on TV, and I think people are going to find it with relative regularity. So I think it's a smart move by ESPN, honestly, to go in on this rivalry, at least just in this one, you know, little isolated incident. And that'll be a cool deal because most of the games will be, the rest of the country will be over by then. So it's a window that they're going to have to really showcase that game. And that's a cool deal for sure.
Yeah. I wish the Big Ten Network were rising to the occasion as well. And, you know, picking up the other two games, but to have the national showcase, and ESPN2 just doesn't show that much college. Like SEC Network is
rare.
Great.
Yeah.
ACC Network is great. They use ESPNU a lot, but to get onto one of the big ESPNs, like, it doesn't happen all that often. So I think that Sunday afternoon, 4:00, you know, maybe the Masters will frankly be over by then. I mean, the green jacket won't have been put on yet, but maybe you'll know. So I would definitely say check this one out if you find yourself on Sunday afternoon into the early evening thinking about, like, well, what do we got on TV? Like, Michigan, Ohio State, ESPN2. That's a very good appointment to make. All right, Joe, I talked about the series that I picked out. They were kind of the most prominent series. We're now throwing it to you for your pick of a slightly more under the radar pick for something that college baseball fans should be checking out this weekend.
So hat tip to you on this one, because I was kind of unaware of it, that it was had the prominence.
I did this to myself.
Yeah, you did. You really did. Had you not said anything. Now, maybe I would have landed on it eventually anyway. But so we've got a big one in the OVC this weekend. So strap in, folks. We've got Murray State, which is 6-3 or 4-2 in the conference, depending on how you look at it. I think they had a conference series or a series against Eastern Illinois that does not count as a conference series, if I'm reading their official schedule correctly, or maybe that's incorrect. But either way, they are at the top of the conference. And they're playing on the road at home against SEMO, which is 7-5 so far this season. And I wrote just quickly, I was going to note that I wrote in off the bat, that's your thing, three strikes this week about how congested the Southland Conference is. And that's interesting to me because that's just very on brand for the Southland. You know, the Southland is year after year you've got a team or two at the top and a team or two at the bottom. And then everyone else is kind of in the middle. And for a league that's 13 teams, that's pretty rare. You usually kind of have more defined tiers, but you just don't get that in the Southland. I could have also written this about, by the way, the OVC, where the worst team is 4-8. And the best teams are 6-3, 4-2, and 7-5. Like, there's just not a lot of separation here at all. I think it's just a real free-for-all in that conference this season. But Murray State and SEMO are off to two of the better starts here. Good for Murray State, obviously. You know, SEMO is no stranger to being in this position. So, but for Murray State, it's a little more rare for them to be at the top of the conference at this stage, even as early as it is. Murray State's kind of interesting because they do have a series win over Jacksonville State already, which is, you know, going to, whether or not they end up at the top of the standings, that's who we had picked in the preseason. I think it's probably the most talented team in the conference. So that's already a good feather in their cap to have. And while this is a non-conference series, they also have a series win over Memphis, which is, you know, not within the realm of the American, not a very a good team, but, you know, for an OVC program to go win that series against a team that has a first round pick in Hunter Goodman, that's really kind of a big deal. So they've played pretty well. Offense really kind of revolves around Jordan Cozart and Brock Anderson, two guys who were off to great starts in 2020. Whenever we were doing all of our offseason top 25s, where Teddy and I were ranking, you know, the top 25 of this or that or the other thing, whenever we were doing offensive top 25s, whether it was best games of the 2020 season, likeliest players to win the home run race in 2020, all of that kind of stuff, Jordan Cozart and Brock Anderson's name came up in like every one of those, at least as candidates. And they are hitting the ball well again this year. Pitching wise, 5.45 ERA.
Oh, it's the OVC.
Well, I was going to say, in the OVC, that's not an alarming ERA. However, if you are going to be the best team in the OVC, it'll probably have to be a little better than that. The best teams in the OVC are usually a tick better than that. Not a high strikeout team. You know, probably a little more walks in the pitching staff than they would ultimately like. Jack Winninger's been the best starter for them. But this will be a tough matchup because SEMO is one of the more talented teams in the conference. And it just hasn't. It's been pretty good this year within the realm of the OVC, but it hasn't been as good as I thought they could be so far. They've got a guy in Dylan Dodd is their best starting pitcher. He's an arm, the quality of which is better than a lot of what you see in the OVC. Like, the OVC will have a guy or two every year, and he's one of those guys. Really hard thrower who's having a nice year. Offensively is a little bit more of a head scratcher. This is a pretty offensive program typically, and they've got a lot of veteran pieces. I'm talking about Danny Wright and Connor Bosler and Wade Staus, who just aren't hitting like you would have expected them to. I mean, these are guys who've been in the program a long, long time, and they're just not having very good years, frankly. So I would expect that to get a little bit better as the season goes on, but we shall see. So I think this is one of the reasons I picked this series is because I think if Murray State is going to really be a contender here in the OVC, I think this is the type of series where, you know, I think it's either going to prove it has some staying power or it's going to get exposed a little bit here. Now, it is at home and that helps, but SEMO is a talented enough team that if Murray State has kind of smoke and mirrored their way to this relatively quick start they've had in the OVC, SEMO is the type of team that can kind of smoke that out a little bit. So I think it's an interesting measuring stick series for the Racers in particular.
Well, we're going to call this the Hog Bowl, I guess, because the other interesting thing about these two teams is they both played at Arkansas already this year, and weekend series at that. And, you know, I think at the time I talked about how, like, yeah, isn't it kind of weird that Arkansas struggled against Murray State and SEMO and game ones? And like, well, come to find out, these are two of the best teams in the OVC. And, you know, they sure, you know, Jack State might be at the end of the year, but I mean, the fact that Murray State already has a series win there was enough for me to flip the field of 64 projection at this point to Murray State. You know, probably whoever wins this weekend will be in next week's field. But yeah, I mean, it's I think you're definitely right about it being a good test because, you know, SEMO traditionally is a little bit better pitching, and maybe that's just because Steve Beezer was a really good pitching coach when he was at SEMO, but I do think that they've kind of carried that legacy a bit, and they're going to throw the ball pretty well this weekend. Now, Murray State, you know, as Ask Arkansas, like they've got a couple good pitchers over at Murray State, but if Murray State can turn this into something more of a offensive slugfest, I don't know that Simo is going to keep up. But yeah, this is kind of the, if the Racers get past this test, I don't know what test they would have left. I think you would just have to call them the unqualified favorite in the OVC for the rest of the year, considering that they would have beaten Jack State and SEMO to this point. And, you know, they are officially have only played those three conference series that EIU won, was a non-conference, Joe. If they pull this off within the first month, knocking off SEMO and Jacksonville State, that would be quite the start to OVC play for Murray State.
It's just a year, I think, in the OVC where, I think right now anyway, there's still time for things to change. But right now, I think you've just got a confluence of a handful of teams led by, I think, Jacksonville State and SEMO, who have maybe played a little bit under what I assume their potential is. Belmont, too. I would put Belmont in that group. And a group of teams led by Murray State and SIU Edwardsville, frankly, which is sitting at 6-6. They're on pace for their best season in the OVC in a long time, who have played a little bit maybe better than we thought. And so I think you've just got this mess kind of that you've ended up where everyone's more or less kind of in the same place. And I look forward to seeing if anyone gets any separation here, but I kind of doubt it.
I think Dan Skurka, who is the Murray State coach, deserves a bit of a shout out here. I mean, this is his third season. Obviously year two didn't really, I mean, count it how you want to count it as the COVID season, but he's done a good job here, you know, kind of remaking Murray State into something. And, you know, when they hired him, he was an assistant coach at Walter State, which is, you know, one of the best junior colleges in the country, but, you know, he was Walter State's assistant coach when they went and got him. Previously had been an assistant at Murray State. I didn't think much of it at the time. You know, Murray State hadn't been particularly relevant lately. You know, it's just one of those coaching hires that falls under the radar as, you know, we're dealing with other coaching changes, the NCAA tournament and the aftermath of the draft, like all of that stuff just kind of runs together. And when they make 30 changes a year in baseball these days, it's kind of hard to give each its appropriate merit. So that one for me fell under the radar, but he's done a great job in just a few short years here for Murray State. All right. Those are the biggest games. Biggest series, I should say, of the weekend, the ones to watch. There are several other good ones. Like I mentioned, the ACC in particular is good at providing some top 25 series this weekend. So plenty to watch, plenty for us to talk about next week on the Baseball America College Podcast. We'll be back here on Monday to recap the weekend. You can subscribe to the Baseball America Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere where you get your podcasts. Subscribe, follow, whatever you want to do, just hit that button there, and we'll drop a new episode into your phone on Monday, recapping this weekend. Until then, you can read all about it over at baseballamerica.com, and Joe and I will have further analysis on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. I want to thank everyone for listening to this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting it. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America College Podcast.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.